Shakespeare play, where if you were there during Shakespeare times, they would have the person come out and tell the story before they told the story, including the ending. So let me get right to the ending as we wait for our slides to come up, and that is that this patient activation measure, we think, has a lot of interesting things in common with stages of change measure. How many are familiar here with trans-theoretical model or Prochaska stages of change theory? So about half of us know that model. How many here, though, are, as Bruce suggested, familiar with this relatively new patient activation measure? So no one here. So this is going to be new learning for you, and I'll then highlight mostly the features of the measure and then get you started thinking about to what extent, as we've been thinking about, it complements versus competes with this stages of change measure. To get you into this space mentally now, think of those patients who are getting infected because of those busy nurses. Think of those poor patients with failure to rescue because those poor nurses. That, my theory, Bruce, by the way, is that those nurses are just busier and busier, that the staffing is such that they have this core value, having worked in healthcare for 20 years, of making sure patients don't fall, that they don't get infection, get turned for their ulcers. They've just been working harder. So we're going to get to that tipping point one of these years. Where even hardworking nurses can't overcome some of these staffing barriers. So at any rate, think about that world in which people with chronic conditions or acute conditions, diseases like Dorothy's foot surveillance, same way, increasingly we're going to have to get into this world where patients are much more attuned to how to self-manage. So that's what this patient activation measure is about. It's about patients who self-manage. Janet Fowles is my co-investigator for this grant. I'm the PI, and she's the first author on this particular paper. And you'll see some of my other colleagues here, but let me especially feature Judy Hibbard, who is the author and the originator of this scale. So we were delighted to get her on this three-year Centers for Disease Control-funded research project. This is a randomized controlled trial, and what I'm going to walk through fairly quickly is what problem are we talking about here? Bruce did a nice job of previewing it. What is this patient activation measure that we think you ought to start getting interested in? It may be useful for foot surveillance, for example, Dorothy, so pay attention here. What are our results? And then how do we interpret these PAM scores and then haunting questions at the end, given we're just post-Halloween and so we're still thinking about some other questions that this study doesn't answer. The problem we're trying to solve, and I think Judy Hibbard was trying to solve in putting together a patient activation measure in general, is that the world is changing, that as with the baby boomers head into the healthcare system of the future, increasingly chronic illnesses, or again, are the illnesses of the day, increasingly that's going to require self-management, especially if the nurses are too busy to even turn people in their beds for bed sores. And increasingly, it's a health system, though, that's built on acute problems. So many of our measures, so many of our monitoring tools are really oriented towards an acute care system. What kind of measures will help us better understand chronic disease management was really Judy's real motivation behind putting together this self-reported measure. It's a 13-item scale. All of them are disagree to agree, kind of Likert scale. It's really mostly been tested with chronic illness management, so we think this is one of the first studies to test this with an employee population who, of course, many are patients, and some of these questions relate to how they do as patients. And this has similar complexity as Lynn just described, this Rausch psychometric model. Is anyone familiar with that? Anyone used Rausch? I'm not a statistician. The best I can do is describe this as a sophisticated factor analysis-like process that Dr. Hibbard and her colleagues used to develop this measure in the first place. It's just this methodical going over and over of items and item comparisons until you feel like you've got the 13 items reduced to the ones that really are most predictive of this idea of patient activation. So here are the kind of things we're asking, and as I read these questions, think about health locus of control, those of you who are interested in health theory, or think about self-efficacy theory, or think about even health belief model. That's the tenor of those kind of questions. But again, these are all around activation. So when all is said and done, I'm the person who's responsible for managing my health. I strongly agree or disagree with that. I know what each of my prescribed medications does. I strongly agree or disagree with that. I know how to prevent future health problems with my health condition. I'm confident, self-efficacy kind of item here, I'm confident that I can maintain lifestyle changes like diet and exercise, even during times of stress. So these 13 items are about how activated these patients are and how they feel in terms of self-management of chronic conditions. So today, we've used this scale in a randomized controlled trial of two work sites. We were testing just in the bigger study. This is just a subset of a larger study. Our interest, anyone here following health coaching as a new phenomenon in healthcare, nurses who get on the phone with people and help manage their chronic conditions, or lifestyle counselors who get on the phone and help people manage their smoking or weight or again, chronic conditions. Well, we were comparing what we call the nurse navigator, a nurse that mainly focused on how to help them navigate around the healthcare system, to these more traditional coaches who did things like lifestyle coaching. We had two companies, an airline company in Minneapolis, guess who, and then a healthcare worker setting in Minneapolis. This is spring 2005 data. So just some of the findings I'll go over quickly, because if you don't know this scale, these won't mean much to you. But one of our contributions, we think, here is that Judy did most of her testing on adult hospitalized or healthcare visitors, so it included a pretty strong Medicare population. This is the first relatively good sample with an adult employed population, and as you might expect, we see a little bit higher patient activation in this adult educated employed population than we did in the population that included Medicare. And then our raw scores, we showed Judy had a little bit more of a range, from a little lower lows and a little higher highs. And then we started looking at independent variables, and we looked at all the ones you might imagine, like demographics, age and gender and education and the like. We'll report a few things there. We looked at whether or not the company they worked for, the job category they were in, made a difference. This idea of presenteeism, anyone know that variable, presenteeism, because it interacts in interesting ways. That word means people come to work sick all the time. About 40 to 50% of us, when you think of colds and flus and allergies and headaches and backaches, come to work not feeling very well. This presenteeism item asks you basically how productive you are at work, even though you're there not feeling your best. And so that interacts in interesting ways with this activation idea. We looked at health risk, and we looked at health status measures like SF-12. So here's some of our initial findings that, again, are contributions to this new scale. That we did find that gender, in this case women, as you've often heard, women are the healthcare decision makers. Well, it also translates to them feeling more patient activated. We did find those with higher job satisfaction were more likely to be patient activated. BMI interacted in interesting ways in the direction you might expect, with leaner body mass people feeling more activated. And then it also interacted in ways we would expect with physical and health components of health status. We were surprised at how many things, though, weren't related to patient activation, like the rest of our demographics, like so many of those work environment issues, and like health status, general health status, and chronic disease. That was really kind of the troublesome one for Dr. Hibbert, of course, the originator of this scale, who's mainly looking at how to understand this patient activation measure, especially with people with chronic disease. So us seeing not very much interaction or correlation there, you'll see when we do our factor analysis, it does crop up though. And then this idea of presenteeism, at this point we're still working on these data. I don't believe those number of missing cases, so we're going back to the drawing board on that one. And then when we do control though for age and gender and race, we do find this significant relationship to readiness for change. That's back to my Shakespearean introduction. That's going to be the punchline I'm going to get to in a minute in terms of the end of the story here. And then we did find interesting interactions in the direction you would expect, with people being proactive about breakfast and exercising and eating their fruits being more activated, having a personal physician being more activated. But some things we found interesting that it wasn't related to, like whether or not you're a health club member. And then finally, significantly related, as you might imagine, to information seeking. Of course, people who are more activated, more likely to say they're in charge of their health and responsible for their health even under stress, are the kind of people who go out and seek information. Somehow the internet didn't seem to relate. But then here's the two new contributions. What's the meaningful difference in TAM scores? We lined it up beside the stages of change. Sorry, I have these out of order. Here's the differences, and here's let me talk first, and this is the real punchline. At first, we went in thinking the stages of change has a lot of similarities to patient activation. Wouldn't it usually be case? Wouldn't it have face validity to say those people with less readiness to change might also be those people with low activation? So that part showed up to be true, and if you look down the Prochaska scale on the left, it does line up in a linear way like you would imagine with these TAM scores, with those people already doing something, being the most activated. The interesting punchline here is that we found equal levels, though, of participation in our coaching programs from people on the high end of the scale on PAM, but not from those people, obviously, on the high end of the scale on Prochaska. So think about that just for a second, because it's the only rest of the story I want to really have you think about if you're ever going to get around to using something other than stages of change. With stages of change scale, we often say those low readiness people aren't ready for intervention, and so we'll do more awareness things with them. Don't believe that to be true, though, with low patient activation measure people. They actually are ready to go get engaged. So it might be an interesting sweet spot where we look for both scales and look for people with high, with low patient activation and high readiness to change as being a new interesting sweet spot. We did show some differences by items in terms of meaningful differences in the patient activation scale. That, again, is a new contribution. Dr. Hibbert hadn't had a chance to look at how well this holds up pretty much across the board of the items we showed. People who don't eat fruits or don't eat breakfast or don't use health resources, and the low end of their mean against the higher end of those more. So it really was a nice affirmation of her scale. So we confirmed, in summary, the negative relationship to health status once we did our factor analysis, and the positive, very strong relationship, as you might expect, to health information seeking. We found some new results that people with BMI and good job satisfaction and more personal activities had higher activation, so that's a new contribution. Some limitations, like Lynn had limitations. These are two large employers, and whether or not this can be generalized to other kinds of employers is an open question. This is an English-speaking population, fairly well healed in terms of being employed and insured. This was a cross-sectional study. Our haunting questions is, how does this relationship to health status work? And Dr. Hibbert is quite interested in that question as well. And is it a global intervention? If it's responsive to intervention, stay tuned. That might be next year's paper, because this was all baseline data, and we'll have post-intervention data to share next year. And so if you saw a person, how activated they are, would you know what to do in terms of an intervention? We don't know the answer to that yet. And then could this be used as a measure of patient performance? Stay tuned for Dorothy's foot surveillance study. Could a scale like this, for example, help predict whether or not those amputations are on the way or not? So I would be pleased to field a question or two, because I do apologize, I need to run to a flight as well.